This is the NetGroup Investments Insights Podcast, where one or more of our experts explore a variety of views and insights that investors care about.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of our Quarterly Insights Podcast, where we explore the issues shaping markets, economies, and investor thinking. I'm your host, Rob Johnson, Head of Investments at NetGroup Investments. Now, my expectation is that most listeners will concur that we are living through a period marked by geopolitical conflict, persistent inflation, elevated interest rates, rapid advances in AI, and ultimately significant uncertainty. Now, these themes formed the basis of a thought-provoking presentation at our recent Global Investment Summit in London, delivered by Nick Andrew, our Managing Executive at NetGroup Investments. Today, we're going to continue that conversation and explore a bit further where the investment playbook itself is changing. Nick, welcome back.
Thanks, Rob. It's really great to be here.
At the beginning of your presentation at the summit, you asked delegates to imagine that they were sitting in a conference room a year ago and doing some scenario planning for the year ahead. Could you talk us through that exercise, the important illustration you made, and why it is so important for investors right now?
Yes, I think it's a useful reminder of just how difficult forecasting can be. If I had asked you or investors a year ago to imagine the scenario where there's ongoing tariff uncertainty, oil was above $100 a barrel, the United States was at war with Iran, had invaded Venezuela and threatened Greenland, that long bond yields were at a 20-year high, and consumer confidence sitting at multi-decade lows. Most of us would probably have assumed that risk assets were going to have a very difficult year. And yet the reality is that the S&P 500 has been near record highs, while the VIX, which measures volatility and risk, has been near multi-year lows. The point is that this outcome feels counterintuitive, which shows that markets often behave in ways that people do not expect. And to me, this reinforces a simple point. Making predictions, especially about the future, is a very humbling exercise.
Yeah, absolutely. And that sets up the idea you quoted from Howard Marks, who famously said, "You can't predict, but you can prepare."
Exactly. And I think those words, "you can't predict, but you can prepare," are absolutely brilliant and so relevant at the moment. His view is that the future of markets and economies is inherently unknowable. So the objective isn't to build a portfolio that's perfect for a single scenario, but instead to build one that can survive and hopefully thrive across a range of different scenarios. His framework is quite simple. Firstly, accept randomness. Secondly, build resilience. And thirdly, control your own behavior. That mindset is relevant for this environment that we're currently operating in.
So at this year's Global Summit, you decided to focus on five structural trends and ask what you called the most important question in each case. So what?
Yes, because there's currently no shortage, and there never is, of headlines and noise. So I wanted to step back and focus on a few big trends that we believe are worth watching. And then more importantly, ask what might that actually mean for investors, advisors, and businesses.
So if we start with macro, the top-down perspective, interest rates and valuations, you said that when thinking about markets, a good place to start is interest rates because everything else is priced off them. Why was that your starting point?
Partly because everything is priced off them, but also because I think the environment facing policymakers has become much more complicated. Take the incoming Fed chair, Kevin Warsh. He has a genuinely difficult job. The president who appointed him wants lower rates, but inflation has remained above target for more than 60 consecutive months. US debt has doubled over the last decade to almost $39 trillion. And the US now spend more on interest than on defense and education combined. At the same time, in the first quarter, dissent on the Federal Open Market Committee is running at levels last seen 30 years ago. And the bond market, which Scott Galloway refers to as the ultimate adult in the room, is sending its own signal. The 30-year Treasury yield sits at its highest level in almost two decades.
Yeah, that's quite incredible where we're sitting on the bond yields at present. You also presented another question, but it wasn't about where rates go next. It was about what potentially breaks if rates are significantly higher than what was anticipated and what we've actually seen come through?
Yes, I think that's exactly the question that investors should be asking. If rates remain significantly higher than people anticipated and that we've been used to, there are two obvious areas worth paying attention to. The first is long duration assets. We're seeing many, many companies now valued on cash flows that sit a long way into the future because they're currently not making money. And the math is quite simple. The value of those future cash flows looks very different when you discount them at the current rates of 5 or 6% than where we've been in the last 10 or 15 years at around 1.5%. The second area is highly leveraged businesses, particularly those that may need refinancing. Those are the area where higher rates for longer can have a meaningful impact. We're already seeing some of these pressures emerge within private equity and private credit markets. And in the end, the practical thing to do is to try to understand where vulnerabilities might emerge if rates stay elevated for longer.
Yeah, that's very interesting based on the cost of debt and servicing that debt for companies, especially if they are overextended. Now, the second part of your macro discussion took that a bit further and focused on valuations, where we currently are at the moment. Despite all the uncertainty in the world, markets appear to be maybe comfortable. What stood out to you in markets at present?
Yes, one thing that stands out for me is, as you mentioned, despite all this uncertainty, we're sitting at really high levels, and that there are some very experienced investors we know who appear to be cautious. An example would be Warren Buffett and Greg Abel from Berkshire, who are now sitting on close to $400 billion in cash. And that doesn't necessarily mean markets are about to fall, because these two have been wrong for a while, and they have been wrong before. But their view on current equity levels and the lack of obvious bargains is difficult to ignore when it's gone on this long. The other thing is that a number of relative valuations are now sitting at multi-decade extremes. That might be emerging markets versus developed markets, minimum volatility versus momentum, or quality versus growth. And the divergence is really extreme. In some cases, it's several standard deviations away from the normal. And what this really tells us is that at the moment, the market in many ways is behaving as if there's only one game in town. It is AI and then almost everything else.
It's incredible that that figure that you quoted on the $400 billion in cash that Berkshire is sitting on, because if you think about it, that's larger than the market cap of the majority of the S&P 500 companies. So that's interesting because you also highlighted concentration risk. And as you said just then, it's AI and almost everything else. A lot of the market has been driven by companies that are related to the AI growth. So when you highlighted concentration risk, as a consequence, is this a result of what you've just described?
Absolutely, Rob. And I'll give you a few examples which just show how extreme some of this concentration has become. If we look at the S&P, the top 10 companies now account for roughly 40%. In emerging markets, it's even more. The top five companies account for 30%. And in Korea, probably the most extreme example, the top two companies, because of the great run in semiconductors, now represent half the market. And this creates a very real concentration risk. Investors may think they're diversified because they're in an index, but in practice, a large part of the market is being driven by a relatively small number of counters. Another example is Apple. Over the past decade, Apple has now bought back more stock than the combined market capitalization of 488 companies in the S&P 500. And I think this is just a nice example that gives you a sense of how big some of these companies have become.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. So if the markets are increasingly priced around this one dominant narrative, how should investors approach the temptation to say, this time is different, that old dangerous phrase in the investment industry? And in that environment, why do valuation and diversification still matter?
I think the temptation is always there, particularly when a market narrative feels so powerful and the companies leading it are genuinely so impressive. And AI may well prove to be transformative, and in some respects, this period does feel different. But this time is different are still dangerous words in investing, because they can make investors less sensitive to price and less aware of concentration risk. Even great businesses can become poor investments if the expectations embedded in their share price become too optimistic. And that is why valuation still matters. The price you pay today remains one of the biggest determinants of your future return. And diversification still matters, because when markets are priced around a single scenario, portfolios can become more exposed to a particular theme than investors realize. The challenge is not to ignore innovation, but to stay disciplined about it, when what you're paying for it and how much of your portfolio depends on getting it right.
Thanks, Nick. I mean, that's a very interesting discussion there on what we might be thinking about this week, particularly as a number of the central banks are announcing this week. Now, if we shift tilt slightly, one of the other areas or structural trends that we are seeing emerge and you identified is geopolitics. Now, when we talk about geopolitics, it can sometimes feel like a constant stream of headlines, noise, policy shifts, political noise every day, driven by a certain person to the West. But your point was that something more fundamental has changed in this area. What do you think has changed most, and what or who is the force behind this shift?
Yes, I think when we reflect on this, it's very interesting because it does feel like things have changed, and that geopolitics now unfolds almost in real time on social media rather than through the diplomatic channels we grew up trusting. And it's impossible to separate the discussion from President Trump, who now absolutely dominates the narrative. An example, in April alone, he made 565 posts himself on Truth Social, which were then amplified across other social media, repeated in the mainstream media, etc. And that level of attention changes the rule of engagement, not just in US politics, but in how the US deals with other countries and how quickly policy positions can change. The uncertainty around policy and global relationships also makes planning for other governments much harder. Countries and companies have to respond to a US superpower that is operating now with a very different rulebook. Certainly in South Africa, we felt this, but so have long-standing allies like the UK and Canada.
Begs the question, if he's posting 565 times, who's actually running the country? But anyway, let's not get bogged down in that discussion. You also link this to geopolitical shift to a broader move towards self-reliance. What do you mean by that?
Yes, this is quite a big trend that we've seen of companies and particularly countries looking at self-reliance, and it just shows how much geopolitics has shifted. Countries are saying we can't be as dependent on each other, in particular in the areas of energy, defense, and technology. And Larry Fink, who's the BlackRock CEO, he's spoken about this quite extensively when in his travels around the world, he's hearing this same version of, or some version of exactly the same message across the different places and countries that he chats to.
But given what we've seen play out most recently, that actually sounds quite sensible on the surface. But what's the investment implication of all that?
Yes, I think self-reliance at first glance sounds sensible, and in many respects it is. But the challenge is that self-reliance is really expensive and needs to be funded. Building domestic capacity, defense industries, investing in energy security, all of these things require capital and lots of it. And I don't think that funding can come from bank balance sheets. A significant portion of it will need to come through the capital markets and the asset management industry. To me, though, it also points to a world that is less globalized and less interlinked than one many investors have become accustomed to. And in that kind of world, it's likely also to be more inflationary and potentially more prone to conflict.
So we may be operating under a different set of assumptions than the ones that have shaped the previous era.
That's exactly the point. A number of the assumptions that we and investors have relied on for years are now being tested. And again, that's why preparation becomes more important than prediction.
And that last thing you just said there is actually very pertinent as we move on to another major shift that you highlighted, which is demographics, which is sometimes feel like a slow-moving, long-term issue. But your point was that the change is happening faster than many people expected. So we have to prepare for that. What is changing in global demographics, and why does that matter for economies, labor markets, and ultimately investors?
Yes, well, one of the big demographic shifts is the really sharp decline in birth rates. So to give you a sense of this, around two-thirds of the world now has a birth rate that sits below the replacement ratio. The replacement ratio of 2.1, which is the level generally needed to keep a population stable over time. But what's striking, and you mentioned this, is not just that it's happening, because we have been talking about this for some time, but that the pace of change has been faster than many have expected. And there are a few reasons behind it. One is that people are having fewer children than they say they would like to have. And that points to broader social and economic pressures. For example, lower levels of home ownership, more young adults living with their parents, can delay relationships, marriage, and family formation. Another factor that stands out, and that was very interesting in the research, is the introduction of smartphones. And the data suggests that when smartphones are introduced, fertility rates in several countries have fallen sharply. And that may be linked to people interacting less in person, forming fewer relationships, or simply living more digitally mediated lives. And the bigger point is the long-term implications of these changes have quite profound implications for economies, labor markets, public finances, and ultimately investment and financial planning.
Yes, that definitely does. And if birth rates are falling faster than expected and workforces are starting to shrink, the demographic story shifts from being a support for growth to a potential constraint. How does that change the way we operate?
Yes, for much of our investing careers, we've benefited from what economists often call a demographic dividend. That means a growing workforce, which then supported economic growth and consumption. But that picture is changing. BlackRock have just released some interesting data and research showing how employment growth over the past 20 years compares with what's expected in the next 20 years. And that demographic dividend is now certainly turning into a headwind. And it's not just in Japan and Europe where we've come to expect that because of their aging populations and shrinking workforces, but increasingly in the next couple of decades, it's also going to impact both the United States and China. And this has got major implications. For governments, it raises the really difficult political questions about how are you going to fund aging populations when there are fewer workers supporting the system. For investors and financial planners, it also challenges some of the assumptions we've relied on for growth, for savings behavior, and long-term returns.
Economists love to coin a phrase, and I'm quite a fan of that one, demographic dividend. these phrases all seem to be coined in hindsight. But when we talk about demographics, it's not just birth rates and aging populations, is it? There's also the question of how wealth is being created and who has benefited from that.
Yes, I think this is a key society question. And that issue is that the younger generation is undoubtedly under pressure. We know that a disproportionate amount of wealth has gone to the asset owners rather than the wage earners. So let me put that into perspective. Since 1990, a dollar invested in the equity market, and we can use the S&P 500 as a proxy, has grown around 15 times more than wages over the same period. So what that really means is that the winners have largely been older, wealthier asset owners, while the younger people have found it harder to build wealth through income and their salaries alone. And that creates a much bigger social and political challenge around inequality, around opportunity, and the sustainability of the current system.
And we're seeing that play out around the world. I found it interesting that you linked that to the rise of speculative activity as well.
Yeah, and that's something that I found concerning. What we found is that younger people feel that the traditional routes to wealth creation have become really difficult or impossible, and that they feel that they can't make it. And when people feel that way, they often start looking for shortcuts and how can I get rich quickly? And I think that's one of the reasons that we've seen growth in areas such as crypto, prediction markets, and sports betting, particularly among young men. And those trends tell us something broader about how young generations view opportunity and wealth creation.
Well, let's stay with the prediction markets you just mentioned for a moment, please. Because they're often presented as a clever way of using market prices to forecast real-world events, what concerns you most about how these platforms are developing?
Yes, there are several things, and I'll use the example of Polymarket in the US. It's essentially a platform where people can bet on almost anything from interest rate decisions to how long someone's going to speak for. But on the surface, it can look like a market-based way of forecasting events. But there's some very clear warning signs. So I'll give you a few of the statistics. Around 2/3 of users lose their money, which probably in betting kind of markets is probably fairly normal. But what is surprising is that a tiny group of users, around 0.1%, reportedly account for 67% of the profits. And that really is a warning sign and suggests that the playing fields may not be as fair as it seems. So the concern is that these platforms can end up transferring money from people who are already under financial pressure to a really small group of better informed or better positioned insider participants. And I don't think that's a healthy outcome, nor does it really move the needle in a meaningful way for the challenge that the youth face.
Well, surely the youth are using AI to bet on these poly markets now. And actually, that's another structural trend that you identified. And no discussion about a changing investment playbook in 2026 would really be complete without deep diving into AI. It's probably going to become the defining investment narrative of this decade. We hear news on a weekly basis about how the spending or capex on companies has gone bananas. I followed your perspective on this topic over time, and it appears more nuanced than either the optimists or the skeptics. In fact, you repeatedly come back to the idea that we simply don't know.
Yeah, I think that is the honest answer. I don't think anyone doubts that AI is and will continue to be transformative. But, you know, one of the people that I follow closely in this space and I highly recommend his reading is Benedict Evans. And, you know, one of the things that he says to almost every AI question has one of two answers. Either, what happened the last time everything changed, or no one knows. And I think there's wisdom in that because humans, we don't particularly like uncertainty. We want answers. But in AI, it's important to remain intellectually humble because there is a radical amount of uncertainty.
Right, I get that. But surely there are some things we know by now. It's been a few years of the AI trend.
Yes, there are some things that we do know. What we do know is that the scale is extraordinary. You mentioned capital expenditure by the largest technology companies. You know, that's gone from levels of $100 billion, which is a lot, a few years ago, to $700 billion in just a few years. And it's heading towards $1 trillion expectation for the years ahead. Another example of scale is on the property side, where data centers, which really barely existed as an asset class a decade ago, now make up more construction value than office construction. So these numbers are just staggering. Even if you look at the valuations that are being assigned to companies such as OpenAI and Anthropic, they really are unlike anything we've seen in previous platform shifts.
And the newest one, CXMT, which IPO'd today in China. You've also referred to this CapEx as a CapEx explosion. I also like that term. But you also asked what you described as the trillion-dollar question. Would you share with everyone what you think that is?
Yeah, the question that keeps me up at night and that I keep asking is, where does the return on the investment come from this extraordinary investment? Undoubtedly, there's been extraordinary growth and there has been extraordinary spending. But ultimately, someone has to earn a return on that investment and someone on the other side has to pay for it. And I don't think that question has been fully answered yet.
And that question around returns leads us to whether the companies building or providing these AI tools have strong competitive advantages. Where do you see the risk there?
Yes, it's very interesting because, you know, one of the realities is that these different language models are very, very powerful and can do amazing things, but certainly at this stage appear to have very low switching costs. Earlier this year, I personally moved from mainly using ChatGPT towards Claude, and it took almost no effort, and there's very little friction. So, you know, what we're seeing is evidence that companies are becoming increasingly sensitive to cost. In the last quarter, we've seen headlines from Uber talking about that it smashed through its AI budget in the first quarter. We saw Shopify discuss the impact on margins, and many, many startups on the West Coast, 90% is one of the figures I've seen quoted, are now using DeepSeek because it's really, really significantly and materially cheaper. So while the technology is advancing quickly, we shouldn't assume that every company in the value chain will automatically earn exceptional returns. If customers can switch really easily and their cheaper alternatives keep emerging, the economics may be more competitive than the market currently assumes.
So bringing all of that together, AI may well be transformative, but the investment case still depends on whether the economics works, i.e. is there a return? How will investors distinguish between the scale of the technological shift and the returns that may or may not flow from it?
In my view, there probably are two different scenarios or outcomes. The first is we could see enormous efficiency gains. And I guess that's the one argument. And in other words, that's saying companies are going to spend really heavily on AI, but then significantly reduce costs. And probably the area where they're going to reduce costs is in the area of labor. The second is the more optimistic scenario, and this would be the Musk or the Jensen Huang or the Peter Diamandis scenario, where they talk about abundance. So that's much higher productivity, faster innovation, which really drives stronger economic growth. I think those are the two potential pathways, and they have very, very different outcomes and scenarios if you play those through to the end game. And that's why I think it's a mistake to take investment success for granted simply because the technology itself is so impressive. Basic maths still matters.
That's wise words on the investment side in AI. But you also had a recommendation relating to AI at the end of your comments. You encouraged people to become part of what you called the AI class. What is that and why should we pay close attention to it?
My view is because none of us know exactly how this plays out, that doesn't mean we shouldn't do anything and we can participate. The barrier to entry is remarkably low. Most people still haven't properly used AI tools extensively yet. So simply using paid versions or experimenting with agents or engaging more deeply with a technology places you in a very small percentage of global users and means that you've got a competitive advantage. And I just think that that is a sensible low-risk approach. Becoming familiar with the technology, understanding its strengths and weaknesses, and learning it by using it rather than just observing from the sidelines.
I like to think I'm part of the AI class. I downloaded Kimi last night, the Moonshot AI tool, which goes to show that not all the evolution is coming out of the US. So let's move on to our last structural shift that you mentioned. We spend most of our conversation talking about the environment investors are navigating. But there is another important point from your presentation that turned the lens back onto our own industry. You said that the asset management industry itself is undergoing structural change. But what does that look like?
Firstly, what I'd like to say, I think it's very healthy for our own industry and for ourselves to acknowledge that we're not standing outside any of these forces. So we're operating within them like everybody else. But to answer your question, one of the biggest realities is that much of the industry's revenue growth, and this is actually both recently but since really the turn of the century, has come from the markets and strong market returns doing the heavy lifting rather than from new client flows. And the industry continues to face fee pressure, product mix pressure, and cost pressure.
And do you see those pressures continuing?
I absolutely do. They've been a feature of the industry, as I mentioned, for a long time. I think that it's a competitive industry and ends up with good client outcomes. And I think that the fee compression is likely to continue. And it is likely to be gradual rather than dramatic. But what that does is it accumulates over time.
So if traditional asset management is under pressure, where do you see the growth happening within the industry?
Well, it's interesting. If you look at global trends, they're really two big areas that stand out. The first is low-cost solutions, and we're seeing large growth of both passive and active exchange-traded funds in the US. And I think that low-cost trend will continue, but my disclaimer and what we need to be aware of is that when we translate across geographies, we need to be aware that some of that specific growth in the US is because of specific tax legislation in that country. The second area of growth is in the more expensive alternative space. So that would be private equity, private credit, and hedge funds. And these are areas where asset growth is expected to remain strong. Again, these assets have a role to play, but I think it's important to approach them carefully.
Yes, that message really came through in your presentation. You weren't necessarily against alternatives, but you were arguing that investors need to understand them properly. What risks should investors be most aware of?
Well, the warning signs around how some of these products have been sold particularly within the retail market, and the risks around liquidity. It's one of the things that I've noticed in the past quarter is that several of the large private credit and private equity managers have struggled to meet fund redemptions, which is a reminder of a very simple reality. It is impossible to make something that is inherently illiquid, liquid. Sure, you can structure around it or manage it, but you can't eliminate the underlying illiquid characteristic. The other thing is that the absence of a daily price movement should never be mistaken for the absence of risk. Sometimes investors see smoother returns and conclude that something is less risky. But often all that's happened is that the asset isn't being priced every day. The risk may be less visible, but it certainly hasn't disappeared. So my view is that alternatives absolutely have a place, but they just need to be understood properly and, most importantly, positioned responsibly.
Just want to highlight that one comment you made. You cannot make illiquid investments liquid just through structuring. Thank you for that, Nick. The final issue you touched on was what may become one of the largest wealth transfers in history. What do you mean by that, and why is it important?
Yeah, I found some of the numbers staggering here, because what it means is that the next generation of investors are going to shape our industry. Cerulli estimates that there will be a $124 trillion wealth transfer by 2048, which is a huge number. What makes it an important area to watch or track is that younger investors, this is millennials and Gen Zs, think differently about money, investing, and advice than previous generations. They've typically got a much broader exposure to different asset classes, are generally more interested in sustainability, are more willing to use and experiment with AI, and are more willing to obtain information through social media platforms.
But your conclusion in your presentation wasn't that advice becomes obsolete. In fact, it was the opposite, right?
Yes, definitely the opposite. If anything, I think behavioral advice becomes even more valuable. You know, technology evolves, portfolio construction becomes more sophisticated, and information is more accessible. But human behavior is the one thing that often remains consistent. So the core value proposition changes less than people expect. Investors still become fearful, overconfident, chase performance, and make emotional decisions, which means good behavioral coaching and discipline remains incredibly valuable. To help someone stay invested through uncertainty, avoid emotional decisions, distinguishing between short-term noise and long-term strategies are so, so important.
That is such a pertinent statement, given the world we're living in today and what's been going on in 2026. And I think that's a fitting place to end, Nick. Thank you very much for sharing your insights and for reminding us that while the playbook may be evolving, the principles underpinning successful long-term investing will endure. And thank you to everyone for tuning in. If you have enjoyed today's discussion, you can read Nick's accompanying thought leadership article on our website. And if you haven't already, please subscribe to Ned Group Investments Insights wherever you get your podcasts. So until next time, thanks for listening.
This podcast is for marketing purposes only. The information contained in the podcast or video was for information purposes and does not constitute advice, recommendation, or an offer or solicitation to purchase or sell any funds or strategies to any person in any jurisdiction in which the offer, recommendation, or solicitation to purchase would be unlawful.